Right, so welcome to episode 6 of the Injimurra podcast. I'm Jack Jacobs.
Stan Grant, and we're with Teela Reid, Wailwan and Wiradjuri lawyer. And Teela, you know, with these things, you begin talking before we turn the mic on. Let's just pick up the conversation where we were and talking about Latrell Mitchell, because this is the day after he was racially abused. And we look at this and we go, again, Adam Goods abused, Latrell Mitchell abused, Michael Long abused, you know, Dean Widders abused. Our athletes who are in the front line, they're out there and they're exposed. And a kid can say that. What does it tell us about the country we're in and the struggle that we're in as well?
It honestly, each time I wake up to witness this, which just seems to be more unrelenting these days, it's honestly like a stab to the spirit, in the sense that I wonder, especially for our young people and more vulnerable people who do not have these incredible platforms, you know, what they're enduring in silence inside police cells, at school,
well,
in the school
yards.
Well,
we know, sadly, because look at the conversations that emerged out of the Kurunjai Walker case that the cops had about us. We hear what they say about us. So imagine.
Yeah.
What we're not hearing.
And my spirit has just felt so heavy this morning about that, because it makes me wonder, because racism is so entrenched and it's the status quo of the everyday Australian life. There actually isn't any consequences. You know, I did see the coaches call for a life ban, and that is absolutely should be the starting point. But remembering as well, our children are sitting in cells right now for a lot less than the racist behaviour and comments that we continually endure every single day. And I'm actually feeling so heavy about it, because we can't continue to accept this behaviour.
And, you know, it's always been there, and got it at school, you got it at school, you grow up hearing this. I watched my boys when they played football get racially abused from parents, from other players. It's always been there, but I'm detecting something else now. I'm detecting a venom, a nastiness. Not that it was not always venomous and nasty, but I'm detecting that there is something in the moment about putting us in our place. It's almost like, who do you people think you are? And children can say these things, that a child can say it to someone like Latrell Mitchell. There's another element to it. I'm feeling like we're at the crossroads of something in Australia. And this lands right at those crossroads.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I don't even feel like I have words for it. It's just a feeling, and because it's so insidious in our society, and that idea of, you know, of what you say about the feeling of putting us in our place constantly now makes me second guess about speaking out about it, because then you're like, are you going to be the next victim? Or are we going to just be continually attacked and racially profiled in ways where, well, we see there are no consequences for this behavior, whether you're a child, whether you're a police officer. And the language.
Think about the AFL, which has had a history of this.
Yeah.
And clubs that have a history of this. And in the rugby league, people who have made racist comments are on our television screens. People who have made racist comments are still running football clubs.
Yeah.
People who have made racist comments are in boardrooms. It's like there's no punishment.
No. It's the white supremacy
that
is consistently, I think, seeping through every aspect of our society, because whiteness equals power. Whiteness equals privilege. And when you wake up and you see that a young, and let's be honest, kid say this to a strong Aboriginal man, I really do wonder about where we're at in this moment. And
the kid thinks he has power.
Yes.
In fact, he knows he has power. Mm.
So are you both picking up a sense that people feel threatened in that power, given this debate around The Voice and where we're at with the Uluru Statement? Is it a backlash?
Exactly. No, I don't. I think
it's not that.
I think it's belligerence. Mm.
So it's even more insidious in some
ways. I think it's because we can, and there is a belligerence to it. And the thing about this too, no matter what Latrell may achieve in his life, that comment is going to hit where it hurts, because the comment lands with all the weight of history. I was standing out the back of the ABC and we were filming something, and a guy and his girlfriend walked by, and this guy, who would have been in his 20s, yelled loudly the N-word at me. And people all around, and people turned their heads. And in that moment, 40 years of journalism, hosting television programs, traveling the world, meeting presidents, shaking the hand of Nelson Mandela, meant nothing. I was the kid at school again. This 20-year-old nobody could reduce me because he spoke with the power of his history, which is what the kid spoke with to Latrell. And when that lands on us, it takes your breath away.
It does. And I think in those moments, what it represents is not just, a racial comment at a particular individual. It's coming from a white supremacist point of view that is, said to attack an entire generation of our young men. To put you back to that child, I do seriously wonder, I've got a little nephew and niece at school today, and I'm wondering, God, I hope that they feel safe today because they're going to hear about this news at school. It honestly, I feel so heavy and often lost for words in moments like this, because I honestly just wonder, when is it going to stop?
So what is it?
Is it going to stop?
What does it say then to the moment we're in? Because this has happened in a year when we're going to a referendum on whether we get a voice. And we're hearing whose voice speaks more loudly, the voice of a 12-year-old, 15-year-old, whatever he was, racist. What does it say about where we're at a nation when we're trying to move to this moment of justice, to bring our voice to be heard in a nation that has not wanted to hear us? What does it tell us?
I think it's so interesting because, on the one hand, there is an enormous amount of goodwill, I believe, in this nation. There are so many Australians from different walks of life that absolutely want to and demand better of us as a nation on a national identity scale. And then you do have these moments where there are, racist comments, racist attacks, racist profiling. And I think it does bring us to our knees about the complex narratives we're dealing with in this country that are yet to be resolved. They're yet to be reckoned with. And I think it's going to take non-Indigenous Australians to confront their own racism and deal with the hard reality and the discomfort of that, and the onus of them having to, I think, do the inner work themselves among their own people about the history of the legacy of white supremacy in this country, because we need to talk about that.
On this, Tila, part of the way that the voice is being sold here is as a kind of redemptive project. This is about, through the language that comes out, bettering Australia as a whole, really white Australia, right? Walking taller, being a fuller, more equal nation. To what extent does that language of a reconciliatory tone actually hide the need to reckon with the history of what's happened in this country in the way that you're talking about? Does the campaign for The Voice speak to that reckoning?
I think the better way to kind of start to have a conversation about this is probably the way in which language has been weaponized.
Yeah, right.
And the way in which language has systemically oppressed First Nations peoples, because Australia was founded on racism.
And language.
Mm-hmm. And language. And that's a powerful thing. You know, we often, most Australians don't understand that their law, this is their law, not our law, that their law founded a document, founded a nation on racism. It's one of the only, you know, legal, political, democratic processes in the world that outrightly and proudly says we have a race power and we're going to use it. And so for me, especially growing up in my community, and understanding the legacy of what my ancestors went through, both my maternal and my paternal sides were forced onto missions as a result of language and the weaponization of language, you know, classing us as Aborigines, dispossessing us from our lands. I was able to grow up, fortunately, in a kinship that really instilled within me, one, the power and the way in which white law is a weapon, and, you know, on top of that, the oral stories about the survival and the strength, the resilience and sovereignty of my people. And often, as a lawyer now, I'm trying to navigate these many different narratives and reckon with them, but I absolutely think it does start with us understanding, and when I say us, Australians understanding, they've actually built a system here designed on racism.
It must be a tension for you, Sue, to be a Wiradjuri Wailwan person, practicing the law that the British used against us. How do you resolve that tension?
It's constantly a battle.
Maybe it's not in the resolution, actually. It's in the battle, isn't it?
It's in the tension in the battle. Yeah.
It's, for me especially, I've had to realise, having been gifted as well, the stories of my old people, and, on, you know, like there's a story in my maternal line, my maternal-paternal line, about one of my great grannies, Elsie, who lived on a mission in Galaganbone, and she, you know, a police officer tried to walk into her garden, and she said, "You stop there." You walk back out and you put your hat on, and you tried to summon her to court. And then a lot of different racial profiling of her happened following that event. But she argued her case, and she ended up getting him dismissed from the police force. And what inspires me is that when we realize the power of who we are within ourselves as proud Wiradjuri Wailwan people, then that's actually the power in it all. That is the confronting part that is, that, you know, white supremacy is yet to deal with, is that they're living here on stolen land, and we have the stories of that within us. So as a lawyer working in these spaces, I often can feel the energy of my ancestors walking into a court, into a room, and I don't have to say a word, and it makes other people uncomfortable in the spaces I work in. It's not lost on me how powerful it is, foremost, being a First Nations woman, with, so happens to be, a skill set in this white law, and I'm constantly navigating the different spaces of that.
Can it work for us, that law?
Well, I mean, there are many examples of it not working. For many years, I was a criminal defence lawyer, and part of my job was just going down into police cells every morning for, you know, 5 years. And it did demoralise me to a point where I was like, am I part of the reckoning for my people, or am I part of upholding this system that consistently oppresses us? And, you know, I remember being in court at Newtown Local Court one day, and the police had put an Aboriginal woman on bail, but she hadn't been charged, but she was somehow on bail. It was just such an abusive process, that it made me realise, if there wasn't someone like me, though, disrupting these systems and helping those people navigate those systems, then, you know, who would know what the outcomes are sometimes? We do know the outcomes of some of our people are sitting inside police cells. They don't come out. And I think as a lawyer working in this system with that ancestor's spirit in me, there is forever a tension there around that. And trying to, I guess, in some ways, be a translator of the different spaces for especially...
I use that word a lot, translation. Yeah. We're translators.
Yeah.
And you know, someone once said to me, all translation is betrayal. And it really cut me because it's true. It's true.
Yeah.
We lose something in the translation. We're trying to translate this world to our people and our people to this world. And we're fighting a battle we can't possibly win.
On that point, so both of you returned back to your country for the Warringah Festival a few weeks ago, Wiradjuri country. What was it like for the both of you being in that place, in that untranslated space with your people focusing on nation building, the exercising of sovereignty? What did that mean to you personally in terms of, you know, reconnecting with that energy, Tila, that you speak about?
I think for me, I got a very strong sense of the power in reconnecting to our stories. You know, I took my grandma down there and she actually recollected in the few days beforehand being there, her paternal line actually was on Warragesna, and she actually had the realization after us being there. So I think there's this somehow the past, the present and the future are always working within us, and that was where I felt completely, I think, centered in knowing that perhaps, you know, is being on country the best place to be, knowing you're going to reconnect.
This is something all you think those, about CERN, isn't it?
Yeah. All those stories.
Yeah.
I describe it really simply as being, I think your word, the untranslated space, untranslated.
The untranslated space.
But I think as well, for me, it is in those moments I feel the perfect alignment of Bayami God, me, and country. Not a slither of light between those things. And the world outside of that, which is a world of endless questions and so few answers, just melts away, and you are perfectly aligned. Past, present, future, history, ancestors, culture, land, spirit, it's all there. And you're right, Tila, it's taken me around the world, covering stories, living in other countries, living in the white world, trying to navigate it, and all of that has led me back to the only simple, the same answer I had when I was a boy. But the only place for me is with my people on my country. That is the only place for us. Doesn't mean we can't do everything else everyone else does. Go and travel, we can live overseas, we can have careers, but there is only one place that is untranslated.
The untranslated place, yeah.
And the other flip side to that, having the access to the privileges of these particular worlds, you know, I actually find it so bizarre sometimes that just by virtue of me having a law degree, the spaces I get to be in.
Yeah.
You know? And
suddenly you're qualified,
yeah,
in inverted commas, even though our people are qualified every day.
Absolutely.
By our culture.
And it's an obligation I don't take lightly, though, because it is the battle of those ancestors that were able to create that opportunity for me. You know, especially having the history of not allowed to speak their native tongue, or, you know, being forced to sign away their Aboriginality, or, you know, having to sit on the opposite side of cinemas from the whites, or walk the certain sides of the streets, or not drink the same milk the white kids were allowed to drink at school. So it's not lost on me the fact that I've been able to walk through these very white institutions, get those pieces of paper, you know, study at multiple universities, including Harvard, and then everything still brings you back to country.
So Tila, can we Can a proposed First Nations voice to Parliament, which is an act of translation, right? Mm. It's trying to find a place for the voices of First Nations peoples within a colonial architecture. Can that speak to the weight of the untranslated space that you're coming from there, of your people? How can it capture the diversity of that experience across all First Nations peoples too?
Well, I think if and when it boils down to me, the language.
Yeah.
The language and the way in which the proposition is put to the people of Australia. You know, you've got over here in the corner the politics and the elites having their debate and argument over words, on the one hand trying to win a political game, but at the heart and soul of that, you have a mandate that has come from a cross-section of our community that embeds within it the cultural authority of the First Nations. And I think that there is an opportunity to get it right in terms of being the First Nations voice that speaks with authority, but it's only if I think the language is settled.
I've really wondered about this in a philosophical, existential way. Can liberal democracy, as it's conceived, which is an essentially weightless idea. So the idea of liberal democracy is a weightlessness. Nothing is tied down.
Mm.
We're untethered. That's essentially what it is. You lose your ancestors, you lose your history, all in the pursuit of freedom.
Mm.
We're not bound even to each other, but we are contractually aligned. We live in within a set of rules, and within that we express our individual selves. And liberalism as an idea, which has become so decrepit and decadent all around the world, it's corrupted by greed, racism, misogyny, the weight of our history. It's corrupted by big power. It's in retreat everywhere.
Mm.
It doesn't hold. It doesn't seem to hold the weight of this moment. And here we are bringing the weight of 200 years and the weight of time immemorial behind that of our culture. I just wonder sometimes whether liberal democracy is even capable of holding it. And that's what we're trying to pull off here.
Yeah.
It's that big, isn't it?
It's enormous, and as you were expressing that notion, you know, we would say kind of in the legal sense, it's about upholding the rule of law, you know?
And that was a concept. Upholding what? And what was used against us?
Yeah, and these principles of law that you get taught at law school, and I do recall a very vivid moment being at law school telling myself to just sit with the discomfort of it all and attempt to see if I could ever reconcile it in my head and heart, because these principles of the rule of law, essentially, you know, one of Dicey's main principles is we're all equal before the law.
We're not.
And that you know, you're in pursuit of that principle as a lawyer, and this is the system that has come in. And the one thing that I knew consistently unsettled me right through all of my formal education was the ignorance of the fact that there is a legal jurisprudence here that is so ancient that no one ever spoke about.
Yeah.
And in my work and in my thinking, I've tried to reckon with it. And I'm not sure if there will ever be the ultimate reckoning or resolution, but the vision is absolutely the reimagining of our sovereignty and being brave enough to do that.
It's a really noble idea, because being thrust out into the world, we leave our communities, our culture, and yet we carry that part with us. But we go in search of the world, and it changes us as we move through it. And I really thought, for a long time, I thought, is it possible to join the Enlightenment, which were all these things come out of, liberalism and the rule of law, is it possible to join the Enlightenment and the Dreaming? And I thought, in the best of worlds, that there is a way for us to live as ourselves within this liberal universalism, this weightlessness. And then I've increasingly come to the belief that we can't. Because it erases us. Mm. And the power already exists, and the power is in the hands of those who designed this system for themselves. You know, John Rawls talks about a veil of ignorance. Well, that's good if you're a Harvard philosophy professor looking out of your window at an Ivy League university. Mm. The veil of ignorance where we don't know our race, our gender, our sexuality, our class. Of course you can imagine that because you have the privilege to imagine it.
Mm.
We can't.
Mm.
And so it's that struggle has taken me a long way trying to reconcile those things. But ultimately it's to the point where I don't think I can. And then that takes you back to Warren Gesda.
It takes you back.
Yeah.
Mm.
It takes you back, and I think the more I sit with that feeling, I kind of do feel and often realize the power of that spirit that I don't think anyone in the country can feel unless you're Wurundjeri sitting on Wurundjeri country. You're Wailwan sitting on Wailwan country. And the feeling of your actual ancestors being there with you, it's almost non-translatable.
It is.
And thank God it
now
is.
Now that I'm trying to explain it, I can't explain it.
And you shouldn't have to.
Yeah.
Because in the explanation, you lose. Because who are you trying to explain it to?
Yeah.
We don't have to explain it to ourselves.
Yeah.
We don't have to.
It just is. You don't have to understand it.
But we have to explain it to the world to exist in the world. For them to see us. And that's the essence of the voice, isn't it? We're trying to explain ourselves to a place that has never wanted to see us. And yet there is a hard realpolitik here, isn't there, Teela?
Mm.
That we have to live in this system.
Mm.
This is not going away.
Mm.
Mm.
Is the voice the answer?
I think we will always be the answer. Our existence in this place is absolutely always the answer. When we talk about structures, though, and the way in which democracy is designed or the rule of law plays out, which it's an unfortunate reality, actually. You know, we can sit here, Stan, as journalists and a lawyer and say what we do is not enjoyable, but it does come with privileges that lots of our people would never have imagined or be able to live. But I just think that back to the point about who we are and what the feeling of that is, and it's bizarre because I've done like hundreds of podcasts and I've actually never done one I've been lost for words.
And it's the first one.
And it's the first one where I've been asked to really take back to this place that I feel you can only feel as a black fella. And there's something about it that you actually can never translate.
Do you think something's lost for you, Teela, when you're forced to leave that untranslatable space and go into the white world and speak back? Do you feel that personally?
I don't think it's a loss.
Yeah.
I think it is a realization that sometimes, oh my God, it's there. And I didn't, and the world tried to tell me it was gone.
Mm.
Yeah.
They tried to wipe it away. They tried to oppress it out of us. They beat it out of our ancestors.
Mm.
And it doesn't matter, like, how many iterations of the systemic racism our people endured, our existence speaks volumes to the fact that this nation will be forever morally bankrupt until it addresses a reckoning of who we are.
There's something unique. I've come to realise there's something utterly unique about us as a people.
Mm.
The rest of the world, because of their proximity to each other, And the great shifts and migrations of people were constantly bumping into each other. And they fought wars and they created governments and religions. And they contested that space constantly. And in that contest, they were forever changed. Mm-hmm. But they can't, but there was no continuity. There was constant change. Mm. And we existed with continuity. And that didn't touch us until 2 centuries ago, when it arrived with such force. But we did not emerge out of that. So the world that arrived here on those boats in 1788 was a world that had already been through the fire. But we hadn't been a part of that. We had truly existed as ourselves in our world, uninterrupted, uncontested and untouched by that crowded world. I think that makes us fundamentally different. And when I've reported from around the world and I've seen the violence of the world, and I come back to us and I don't, thankfully I don't see that in us. Mm. I see an extraordinary grace, a spirit that is unquenchable, that you cannot extinguish. And it comes from that deep, deep, deep place and time. I think we are a very, very different people. And that's a strength, but it also makes me wonder about how we deal with this political moment where we are really having to engage with a political process that in so many ways is foreign and hostile.
And as you were explaining that, it makes me realize something that I've consistently had to confront in my profession. It's the artificiality of these structures and the architecture of what they brought here. And, you know, even something like the economy and money and the way in which, you know, power is structured in these colonial systems, you know, it's hierarchical. It's artificially designed so that, you know, lots of the rules were designed to kind of manage behavior and punish people. That is the system that has been inherited here under Australian law, which is completely at odds with our own ancient laws around kinship and care and country. And so in my head, I've always had a very different vision of what we're dealing with in Australia, which is all of these layers of power and people and egos and structures and architects who, you know, are claiming the rules and who has power to dominate those rules. When you do travel abroad and you get a sense of, you know, I've lived in Turtle Island or Canada, you know, you can go to Rotorua, New Zealand, or different parts of Europe or Asia, and there actually is such a sense of spirit here that is inexplicable. And I don't think that Australians are actually capable of the moral force of that. Because when we do start to talk about democracy, and as a supporter and an advocate for something like the Uluru Statement from the Heart, what had the obligation to my people that drew me, you know, initially to the work, was absolutely about understanding the moral force and the mandate written in that, which had come from a long line of history and a very spiritual expression of our sovereignty. And you see then the way in which that's expressed on the one hand, and how powerful and what a gift that is, on the one hand, from First Nations peoples, and then having it play out in things like newspapers and the media and politics every day is actually infuriating.
So the language of politics in no way honours the original moral and spiritual force
given as a gift by First Nations peoples to this country. You know, no. Stan, you've thought about this a lot, right? The need to speak in the language of justice and the language of the spirit back to Australia. What do you think Australians are longing for in this moment? You use that phrase, Australians need something to believe in here.
I think
are we doing this in the right way?
For me, it's the divine. Because I think that's the spark of humanity in us. I think other than that, we're Homo sapiens, where we can be reduced to science, you know, we can be studied under a microscope. But it's the spark of the divine, and I think that's what lives in us as Aboriginal people. And I think Australians are looking for that. And I think that's what I hold on to in this moment. Australians are looking for it. When I get up and go for a walk on Coogee Beach in the morning, I see young people up at the sunrise. They're not there to take a pretty picture. They're there because they are looking for the spark of the divine. People find it in gay pride and the Mardi Gras. Being amongst people in a place of love, they find the spark of the divine. Sadly, they're not finding it in church anymore because the church has turned away from the divine and is judging people.
Away from love in a lot of ways.
And moralising. Yeah. But by a river, I feel it. On my land, I feel it. In my parents' touch and love, I feel it. Food tastes better when mum cooks it because there is the sprinkle with the love of the divine that is in our people. We have it. When you said before you don't think Australians are up to the moral weight of this moment, I think it's for us to open that, and that's our gift. That is truly our gift. I say to people, I don't think you can be a person of God until you have come to the people of God in this country. And we are that. Mm-hmm. We know that. We know it. And I think that is this moment for me. There's a political reform. There is political architecture. There is a need for better policy outcome. Mm-hmm. There's a need for better, more functional bureaucracy. There is a need to get better outcomes through the law.
To put bread on the table.
I get that. And I cede that to other people because I think that's their domain. But I've just been felt increasingly called to try to join the moment to the divine. I love poetry. I love the birds in the trees. I love the feel of the river. I love to feel God around me, and I think there is something bigger working in the moment, and I just wish that as Australians we could find that, get past the culture wars and the newspaper headlines and the left and the right politics and god awful Twitter and find that.
But you've spoken as well, Stan, previously about I recall one of your lectures which was about this notion of Australia being so used to our suffering.
Oh, God, it breaks my heart.
And
it's factored in. They are comfortable with our suffering.
And so I don't think we can, in that context, ignore the politics and power of this awful architecture.
No, we can't.
That's at play.
We can't. And that's what I see in people like you, Teela, and I see in people like Megan Davis and others. I sort of shudder at that responsibility of that. It's not one I've ever been able to take onto myself because I sort of instinctively and naturally, I think, gravitate to the sort of poetic realm. I just think that's my home. If you can join poetry to politics, that's the spark of the divine in the nation.
And you need both.
And so I look at you now and I just worry. I just think, my God, Teela, like, you are having, and you're young, and you're having to carry this load, and you're having to carry a sword and go into this battle because you know that if you can get $1.25's worth out of every dollar spent on policy, you keep a kid alive. I think that is phenomenal. But it comes at a cost, and I just worry, you know, what is the cost that you're...
Well, I mean, there's no denying it's been quite a violent process when you step into these spaces. You know, I've had a prime minister tell me to wipe my face. This is going to go up in flames. that's his own words. And, you know, I've recently had an Attorney General tell me in blunt terms that language I believe that should be supported is not politically viable. And while, you know, it makes me realize these days, while it's not the bloodshed violence our ancestors had experienced in the past, I still certainly feel their pain when confronted with the colonial project in a way that continually attempts to erase us and diminish us and, you know, ignore the fact that there is such a sacredness here. But it certainly is something I feel when there are those moments and they do come, it's just reminding myself that there's a long line of spirits behind me that have got my back.
Do you think, you know, you said before there's a great level of goodwill amongst us Australians, and we're talking, and I'm watching people walking by, and I know there's not people with evil in their hearts. I know they want something else. Do you still believe, in the face of all of that and the racism that we talked about at the start of this conversation, that this moment can lead to something, that this will be a successful referendum, and that the Australia that we glimpse can become the Australia that all of us see?
I certainly believe, back to also your point and meshing them both together, it's that there is an enormous movement of the Australian people now seeking something deeper than what status quo politics is giving them. And my faith doesn't lie in the political process. It lies in everyday people who can feel and see the racism we're still enduring and actually want to step up to the plate and change their system, their law. Because that's ultimately what we're asking them to do here in this process, is accept responsibility for what you have created and change what your ancestors did. No longer silence us. And I believe there is a window of opportunity where, if that is accepted by the people of Australia, in relation to the mandate of the First Nations voice and having their leaders as the politics put that on the table so the people of Australia can answer, then I do think that that is the window of opportunity where we will see a new chapter written in our nation that sees into the future the enlivening of these sacred nations, the spirit of who we are, and no longer systemically silencing us in this process. But there is a long way to go between today and the end of year when that potentially is put to the people.
Good luck too. Good luck.
Thank you too. Well, that's Yindjimarra, so we better leave that there.
Yindjimarra. Yalu.